What is up, everyone? Welcome to Street Level Floppies, episode number 8. This is going to be a little bit of a different episode than some of our other episodes because we have a multitude, a pile, a giant stack of awesome comic books that came out this week. There were so many good comic books that we decided we couldn't leave many of them off the list. So we're going to do our best to work our way through a big pile. It's going to be fast. Not everybody reviewed every one, but we're going to try to at least give a little love to each book. Chris is not with us for the first part of this podcast. He had another commitment, you know, now that he's big time and he probably has some meeting with Donny Cates or who knows what's going on. You know, he's Mr. Marvel now.
Hanging just, with Jason Aaron.
There you go. Just kidding. Chris is a little bitty, but he's going to join us later in the show. We're going to talk about his book, his experience doing the book, and just share what he does at Marvel as an intern now. That'll be a lot of fun. So we're skipping the news. Our spotlight will be Chris, so we won't have our normal spotlight. And we're going to jump right into the books because we have a lot of books to talk about. Also, really quick, we are members of the Nation of Nerds, as always. It's our pleasure to highlight creator-owned books and small publishers and imprint titles and educate you about some different comic books that you may have not heard of. So without further ado, oh, also, I'm here with Fred. Say hi, Fred.
Hi, Fred.
Sorry, I got so into my spiel because it's different that I got myself lost and all tongue-tied. Yeah. So let's jump right into the books because, like I said, there's a lot of books. All right, the first one we're going to talk about is Blackbird Number 1, an all-new ongoing series from fan-favorite writer Sam Humphries, who did Harley Quinn and Nightwing, and red-hot artist Jen Bartel. In this neo-noir fantasy, Nina Rodriguez is positive that a secret magic world ruled by ruthless cabals is hiding just beneath the veneer of Los Angeles. The problems, everyone thinks she's crazy. The bigger problem, she's not crazy. She's right. Can she unravel the mystery before the great beast catches up with her? Written by Sam Humphries. Art and cover by Jen Bartel. Layout artist Paul Renwand. Colorist Nayoung Wilson and Jen Bartel. Lettered by Jody Nguyen. Variant cover by Fiona Staples, published by Image Blackbird. An interesting thing I caught off that is that Jen didn't color all of it. Because one of the things I love about her art is the way she colors. But she's not responsible for coloring the whole book. But she definitely did that cover. And talk about two great covers. You get the Fiona Staples cover and you get Jen Bartel's cover, who many of you may have seen her work all over the place. She does covers for everybody now. But it's pretty cool that she has her own book. I really enjoyed this book. I didn't know what to expect from it. It was just one of those things like I love her art, so therefore I'm going to buy it because it's going to be look really pretty. But let's see what Humphries does with the words. And I kind of like it. It's about Los Angeles. You have this young girl. Like I said, there's this magical story. It's a little depressing at some points because she's going through a hard time and she self-medicates and she's lost her mother, correct? I think it's her mother, right? I think it is. And just thinking that she's crazy because she saw something when she was a kid and then this spirit, this from another world, then made everybody forget. But somehow she still remembers it. And because she remembers it, she feels she's going crazy. I think it's well written. It's very quick. But again, the art definitely is the standout of this book. Anything Jen Bartel draws, you will know her style. She's slowly becoming that type of artist where you're like, oh, that's a Jen Bartel cover. You know, Fred, what did you think?
Well, the book is definitely interesting. It's intriguing. And like you mentioned, it does delve into like a little bit depression. I enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed the art and the colors. The colors were done really well. I'm interested to see what happens next. It seems a little bit Jumanji to me in a way, but it does, like you mentioned, it does have like a magical realism to this. So we'll see how it goes, but it's definitely one that I have on my pull list.
Yeah. Yeah. She loves color. You know, this is rainbow bright color. That's for darn sure. But you know, some things like she draws women very well. One of my favorite artists, for example, is the late Michael Turner. And I always enjoyed the way he drew Supergirl and some of the things, but some people are not fans of how he drew women because he kind of made them really thin and just the proportions didn't seem realistic. When you look at the way she draws them, they're very realistic, very stylish. She can tell she's totally into the fashion side of things because they're always dressed uniquely fashionable, hairstyles, the whole things. And right. I think it adds to the view, the way the comic looks, and it makes it such an interesting looking comic book. And I trust Humphreys because I've liked his stuff before. I really liked his Nightwing. I really, really liked his Green Lanterns. I liked the way he wrote Jessica Cruz. So I think he's going to get something going. Maybe it just didn't, like you said, not a lot in this first issue. But definitely.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a good read. It's just that maybe I read it after some of these other books that are... It's hard to stack up. Like like we mentioned earlier, on a slower week, you know, where there's not so many releases and things, this definitely would be like a top one. And not to take any shine away from it. It is a really good book and it's one to add to your list. It's just there's so many good books this week.
Yeah, that without a doubt. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a score. I don't know if Fred's going to score this one, but I'm going to definitely score this one a 4. I liked it that much. I really like the art. I think it has room to improve. And I'm definitely going to keep buying it. Fred?
I would definitely give it the same score, 4. It's a solid score. It's definitely, you know, it's worthy of, if it's a 10, it's a 9. Definitely, yeah. I would say
there
that.
There you go. All right. And speaking of good books, we're going to talk about Lone Ranger number 1, a sparking new adventure from multiple Eisner Award nominee Mark Russell, who did the Flintstones, and Bob Kuhn, who did the Green Hornet 66 Meets the Spirit. The advent of barbed wire is creating havoc in the Texas Panhandle. A corrupted state senator conspires with dirty ranchers to make land unnavigable for open rangers and native tribes. Passing new laws allowing cattlemen to kill anyone caught cutting the wire, good people are getting hurt, and the Lone Ranger must act. But to truly stop this rampant villainy, he needs to go all the way to the top and rely on an old friend for help. Written by Mark Russell, art and color by Bob Kuhn, cover by John Cassidy and Jose Villaruba, letters by Hassan Otaman Elahu, variant cover by Frank Alred, and a second variant cover by Francisco Francavilla. Published by Dynamite, The Lone Ranger. Fred.
Okay. As a kid, I remember waking up on Sunday mornings, eating a bowl of Wheaties, and watching The Lone Ranger in black and white. It's how I spent my Sundays. You know, it was after Tarzan. Yes, we had color TVs when I was a kid. It just happened to be in black and white. Okay, with that being said, I'll just let you know that I could not wait for this book. Ever since like it was released in solicits 2 months back, hearing that Mark Russell was to be writing this book made me want to read it even more because I became a fan of his work, like you mentioned in the beginning, because of his Flintstone book. It was really entertaining. And if you haven't read it, I highly suggest to read that book. It's a bit political, but it's good. It's really good. This book right here was paced very well. I felt like the art was extremely awesome, especially the action scenes where there was no words. It almost felt like you were watching it on TV. Now this book is dialogue heavy, but with that being said, it needed to be that way, excuse me, because we're establishing the good guys and the bad guys. We have to find their motives. You know, it's the first issue, but I never felt bored, you know, with all that dialogue. Cause I'm easily turned off with dialogue. Let me tell you, for example, Superman. And he's my guy. But, I don't want to spoil too much. I'm really interested in how this book's going to play out. And at the end, you know, his main man, his Kemosabe, is starting to become introduced, which has me really excited because I can't wait to see those two together.
You know, it's funny when you first brought it up, I wasn't as high on this one. I was like, the Lone Ranger, you know, do I really want the nostalgia? I mean, I also grew up watching the Lone Ranger, but I just wasn't feeling it, like you. And I put off reading it for a while, but once I read it, holy smokes, I remember telling you, man, I'm hooked. This is a great book. This is really well written. It's excited. I mean, I told you there's a little hint of Bruce Wayne in this Lone Ranger, just a touch. Yeah. You know, he's out for vengeance a little bit as the Lone Ranger who survived. You know, it's a little more mature, but it's still a Western. They didn't try to make a modern Western. They just made a Western. The villains are still Westerly villains. These are Westerly, old time, problems. You know, the barbed wire situation, the big cattle barons taking over the land and trying to, you know, fence everything down. So it stuck to what it was, but it was written so well, and it added a little character. And then, like you said, our second character, his faithful companion, the introduction, he's going to be a badass, I think. Yeah. I think he's going to be a real badass. So
I really think he needs to be like I think you mentioned in the message that we had going back and forth, like we're interested to see if he's going to be an equal.
Yeah.
Which I think that's how it should be, definitely, because he trained him.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. And he saved him. And yeah, I want him to not agree with everything the Lone Ranger.
Right, exactly.
I want them to have a little bit of conflict. He's not Robin to Batman. He's, you know, right. Superman to Batman. I want them to be equals. Yeah, definitely. So if you were going to score the Lone Ranger, what would you give it?
Now, let's see. How should I put this? Yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a 5.
Nice. I kind of thought you might.
Yeah. I did hype it a lot, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was, you know, now let's just say this. Western books and stuff isn't for everyone. It's just, I enjoyed it. And the main part that I do enjoy is that it you know, puts a little bit of like political things happening and showing the motives of people, like the racism and things that these mm-hmm. people were facing. And I think that's important because the TV show back in the day, they didn't show any of that.
No.
And this makes it like, it just seems more like he's Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Basically. Mm-hmm. So
I would agree because he's fighting. Yeah. It really does show these guys, these corrupt senator and these landowners in a really ugly light. That you instantly don't like them. There's no gray area. You know, these are the bad right. guys.
Yeah, especially because they make it, I think, what did they point it out to? Rich versus the poor, and who can't get behind that? So
yeah, they make that comparison to plantation life, you know, that the rich people deserve to be on the porch sipping lemonade or iced tea. I can't remember what it was, but some derogatory thing like that. But yeah, I really liked it too. I'm going to give it a 4 as well. I definitely am sold. It's a book I'm going to add. And yeah, don't be turned off by the word Western. You know, look at it right. as a comic, something different. He's still a hero. So I mentioned the Bruce Wayne. You know, this is a guy, he's not quite Punisher level, but this is a guy who's seeking vengeance. You know, the other Rangers were killed. Everyone thinks he was killed too, but there's an empty grave that he's not in. And so he...
To play on your Bruce Wayne comment, like where he shows like his monologue where he's thinking and things like that, it does give you that feel like he's when you see his thoughts and things. So that's well put right there. That's a good point. Yeah.
And as a Batman guy, of course, I was like, yay. I always have to find my Batman and everything. All right. Let's move on to the next book. Okay. The next book is Juke Joint. Originally, Chris was going to do Juke Joint. So even though I read it, I don't really have a prepared review, but we'll give it a shot. All right. Juke Joint. T. Franklin, Bingo Love, and Alita E. Martinez, Black Panther World of Wakanda, team up for a timely horror series from the Deep South. Mahalia runs the hottest spot in all of 1950s New Orleans, and Juke Joint keeps the jazz popping, people bopping, and the women? The women are to die for. There's only one rule, keep your hands to yourself. But some men think rules don't apply to them, and Mahila and her coven of slain women enjoy reminding them that they most certainly do. Written by T. Franklin, art and cover by Alita E. Martinez. Color and cover by Sherry Chankahama. I hope I didn't butcher that too bad. Letters by Taylor Esposito. Logo by Melissa Esposito. Variant cover by Mike Hawthorne and Jody Belair. Published by Image Juke Joint. Like I said, Chris originally was doing this, but I did read Juke Joint. Wow. This is not a book for kids. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. This is a mature book. And there are sexual situations. And there's some scary violence. You know, there's definitely, it is a horror book in the sense of not like jump scares, in the sense of like some pretty graphic murdering and different things like that. It has that voodoo feel that you would expect from a New Orleans story. The art is really good. I liked it a lot considering, but I'm not sure I'm going to be purchasing it. It may just not be for me. Fred, what did you think? Did you have a chance to scour it or look at it?
It's on my list to take a look at. I did see some of the art. We'll see. I mean, I'm definitely going to check it out because, you like you mentioned, Taylor Esposito is the letterer, and I read everything that he does. So I'll check it out. Just had so much going on this week outside of the podcast world.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, the dialogue's snappy. It's good dialogue. You do capture the era very well. It's just, like I said, it's a very mature and it's a bit dark of a story. You know, these women are survivors of different things, like I said, that don't touch. You know, some of these women come to her because they're being abused by their husbands, or, you know, they've just been hurt by men. So therefore, they're taking out their vengeance on men. And they basically, it seems like they feed on them. It's still kind of gray for me, being episode one, exactly what they are, if they're like vampires or what they are, or some sort of demons. But yeah, it's trippy. It's New Orleans trippy. And
yeah, that sounds like some Black Widow stuff.
Yeah,
like spider.
I told you, it's American Gods levels trippy. So if American Gods wasn't for you, this probably isn't for you either. Yeah,
and I would agree with that because I did see the first couple of like panels and things when I opened up the PDF, and I was like, oh, well, I'll put that on later reads. I'm not getting to that one right away.
Yeah. All right.
Definitely not reading that with the kids around, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's not one you leave on the coffee table.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and give it a score because I did read it. I'm going to give it a 3.5. And that's more personal taste, I think, because there are some people that are scoring this book very high, and it does deserve praise. It just isn't the book that I'm interested in. And others may be. So, yeah, that's where I'm going to put it. And Fred didn't read it, so I'm not going to ask for a score. So we'll move on to the next one. All right. House of Muck number 2. The Sandifiers weren't always nuts. They were made that way by stories, conspiracies, and coincidence. As Dylan continues to recount how she spent her summer vacation full of murder, the truth behind how she and her family infected each other with madness comes out. Secrets and blood run deep. But family is forever, no matter how deranged they might be. Written by Christopher Sabella. Art and cover, Sean McManus. Colorist, Lee Longridge. Letters by Aditya Bidikar. The variant cover by Caitlin Yazinski, published by Black Crown, House of Muck. Now, the first House of Muck, we were all fans of. I don't remember the scores. I don't think any of us gave it a 5. Do you? I don't think so.
No, I think like the highest maybe was like, we were around like 4.0, 4.5, yeah. I believe.
But we really did enjoy it. The big difference between 1 and 2 is 1... you kind of were in this weird dream state almost, like trying to figure out what was going on. It was almost like a Tarantino movie showing you the end at the beginning, and then you swing around back to it. This issue is a little more straightforward, as it's almost a flashback episode, and you have young Dylan explaining how the family became the family, how they are, and why they think the way they think. And it's really frightening, actually, that this family went off the rails the way they did. And it was actually more frightening to me than the first issue, which was kind of frightening, that these two little girls tell stories to each other because they're twins, and their father, because he's had a failed business, takes their stories as gospel and runs with it and creates this crazy conspiracy theory that leads to killing and all the crazy stuff they're doing. It's really whacked, but so well written. So, yeah, what'd you think? Did you get a chance to look at it?
I did, and it's very interesting because they kind of use it, like, I think the kids are describing that they're getting, it's like getting sick, you know, like one person in the family gets sick and the rest kind of, eventually it gets to everybody. And that's true because, I mean, in my home, there's five of us here. So if one kid gets sick, you know, so every week somebody's going to have the flu and it's not a good thing. But what's like, it is totally creepy, like, for the dad to start continuing to like believe the lies or the stories. And it just shows like the more that somebody lies to you or something and you start thinking, you start believing it.
Yeah.
And that's like, so it's, that's really interesting aspect because I mean, you could see that in modern day and stuff. People just start believing things. Like they could say they're the greatest and all of a sudden, you know, it gives you confidence. But there's a, you know, who is it? Dylan? She still knows that it's not real. Everybody else thinks it's real.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, Dylan knows that this isn't right, but you know, she talks about it a lot, but it's family. So do you stick to your family?
Right.
Or are you the one that stands up to your family and says, this has to stop? And she doesn't seem like she's able to, you know, at least not yet. She's not able. And she definitely can't stand up to her twin, which that was the creepiest part where she woke up and her twin wasn't there and her twin was out participating with the rest of the family in this without her. I think that was a shocking thing because twins tend to do things together. And I think it was even shocking to Dylan to see that, wow, my sister's out here doing this stuff without me. And yeah, I mean, this is kind of like, there's a political message in this about fake news. You know what I mean? How you can start believing some things you shouldn't believe. Right. And how desperation, because, you know, the father loses his job.
Yeah.
And then that's, the wife's working hard because of it. And then the father or the husband and wife are fighting all the time.
Right.
And you're just like, why is our life going to shit? Oh, because there's crazy alien things that are doing stuff to us. That makes sense because we're not doing anything wrong. It's the crazy aliens that are doing this to us. And how someone could get so desperate that they start believing that stuff. Not the kids, the grown-ups, but yeah.
Yeah, like the part that is, you know, it shows how desperate you can be, like when the dad, like, what was his job? Being a, like, web designer, and he was doing great, and they were having the perfect life, and they were deciding, should we get two dogs, things like that. That part, like, as soon as he started failing, you see how vulnerable people can be, and they just believe anything.
Yeah. And yeah, this book is out there.
Yeah, but it's definitely, it's wicked.
But the art is very well done.
Yeah.
The story is great. It moves along. You don't get lost. You understand what's going on. Dylan as the narrator is pretty interesting, you know, to have a little girl narrating the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, I really like House of Muck. It's grown on me from one to two even more so. So if you were going to give a score, did you read it fully to where you could give it a score?
I think so. I mean, I definitely would continue to give this like a four. It's a solid book, and everything Sabella does, it seems like things are a little bit deranged that he does, especially like Shanghai Red. What, in like next week, I'm sure Crowded comes out. That's going to be a little trippy too. So yeah, man, the guy's on a roll.
Yeah. He takes these concepts that we understand and he really exaggerates them.
Yeah.
To really magnify them for us to see how crazy people can take things. Yeah. Really good. Yeah, I'd give it a 4 too. I'm giving a lot of 4s, but like I said, there were some really good books this week. This was the kind of week that as a comic book fan, you really enjoy. And what I hope is by us doing all these books is if you missed one of these, you go back and catch it next week, which seems to be a bit of a slower week. And you can pick up some of these that you may have missed because there's a lot of good ones. And a lot of them are ones and twos. So good jumping on spots for all of them. Mm-hmm. All righty. Let's go on to the next book. All right. Dead Rabbit number 1. Back in the 90s, Dead Rabbit was a prolific Boston stick-up man and hoodlum until he took down one last big score and disappeared. Nobody ever discovered the truth. He retired to be with the love of his life. Now he's back in the mask to save her. But no one, not his wife, the mafia, or the cops, is happy that he's out of retirement. From John McCrea, the artist and co-creator of Mythic and Hitman, and Jerry Dungan, the writer of Analog and Deadpool, comes the action comedy drama tale of Martin Dobbs, a.k.a. Dead Rabbit, the man who says he's descended from one of the original gangs of New York City. Get on board with this oversized first issue of an all-new ongoing series for mature readers. Written by Jerry Dugan. Art and cover, John McCrea. Colorist, Mike Spicer. Letters by Joe Sabino. Variant cover by Dave Johnson. Published by Image. Dead Rabbit. Fred, this was one of your favorites this week. What'd you think of Dead Rabbit?
Okay. Now, Dead Rabbit. In Gaelic, the word Dead Rabbit or Dead Rabid means a man greatly feared. And we get that kind of feeling in this book because in the beginning, I think it's like people sitting around a bar or a barbershop. I can't remember quite offhand, but the news is on and it's like telling, you know, the legends, like, where is he now or where are they now? And it's like reporting like the type of things he did, like sticking up certain, like Fenway Park, they mentioned. Mm-hmm. They mentioned a couple big things, like and he's in the bathroom, you know, getting ready to get in the shower. Well, actually, he's, you know, it points to, it goes to him, and his wife is like, oh, they said, like, you did, was it $12 million? You got $12 million this time or something when they're talking about it. And he's, like, barely standing there, and he can barely wipe his rear end because he's got hemorrhoids. And I was like, oh, wow. That was a great scene because it just showed, like, you know, the legend and what the real person's like, you know, yeah, what they're going through. I enjoyed that part. What I also enjoyed is like his relationship between him and his wife, because she's in a wheelchair. I'm not sure how she got there. You know, she's definitely has something going on, and he's like feeding her, and the banter between each other is, it's charming. It's, you know, they play with each other. They kind of like I would say, like, my wife and I, we bust each other's balls. You know, we have fun doing that, and I can see that there. But she thinks that he goes and plays golf and stuff when he leaves, but he actually, the money that he had won, they spent it all, I think he said, within a year or a year ago. And he actually, like, so humbled to take care of his family that he's a greeter at basically a Walmart.
Yeah.
I think they call it a mart. But that's when the story gets interesting, because he sees some sketchy people and some things that they're, like, are attempting to get, and he knows what those things can be used for. So that's when the story gets a little bit crazy. And I was definitely interested because it is, you know, I'm a big fan of anything to be like gangster mafia stuff. So once they did that, and especially like the Boston stuff, man, this is a really good book, man. What do you think about it, Andrew?
Yeah, I agree. This is another great book. I believe the money they ran out is because there's something wrong with her medically. I don't remember if they say what, but it's the medical bills piling up. So he had to get back in the life because he wants to take care of her, you know, and he doesn't want her to know, because obviously she would be very unhappy that he's back doing these things. And yeah, like you said, the old guy. I can imagine like a Bruce Willis playing this if this was a movie. You know what I mean? An older guy who has to get back in it, like, they drag me back in this shit, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's brutal, and it's very realistic in ways, you know, like how, and his attitude about things, how he approaches things, like, I know what you're using those things for, I know what kind of person you're doing, so I'm going to go after you. And then even when he kind of like saves people, he doesn't care. He just like, eh, not my problem. Just makes a phone call, 911, and walks out. It's more about the money for him that he's trying to protect his wife. He doesn't want to get involved emotionally. The art is really good. It reminded me a little bit of like something you would see from Robert Kirkman and something like Die 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 or something, that kind of style of stuff. But I really liked it a lot.
Yeah, because I mean, this book kind of gives you like the story of the man behind the mask and then the man with the mask. And it's very interesting because, you know, I mentioned with the Lone Ranger, it's kind of like a Robin Hood feel, but this actually has more of a Robin Hood feel than the Lone Ranger, if I was say it, because he's just like, you know, he kind of like takes a couple people out because they see like they're using women. I don't know if they were using them for trafficking or whatever it may be. They didn't necessarily see, but you know, he's definitely seems like he's, you know, the media plays him to be a bad guy, but it seems like he has a heart.
Yeah, like an urban legend almost.
Yeah.
But as we see at the end of the book, the mob takes him very seriously.
Yeah, and they look intimidated.
Yeah, they're like, oh, he's back. Let's get him. Now's his time for payback. Like the guy that he probably stole all the money from in the first place. So yeah, this is going to be fun. This is a typical image book. When I think of image books, this is kind of like the kind of book I think of, you know. Gritty and street, and it's gonna have funny, yeah, like the hemorrhoid thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's that very image. So,
yeah, it's definitely something that you could see on like TV, and it does make sense. Like you mentioned, Bruce Willis, that would be a kind of perfect casting part, but I don't think he can do that Boston accent, though.
Yeah, you're gonna need a Boston guy. You have to help me with that. Give me a Boston actor that could get that done.
Yeah.
I guess they could give it to Wahlberg, but I've never been a big Wahlberg fan. But no. He could probably pull it off.
Yeah. No, every time I see Marky Mark, I think of like Calvin Klein. I don't know.
Yeah.
I still see it.
Cool. So if you were going to score Dead Rabbit, what would you give it?
We'll give this one a 4.5. It's got a lot of potential, and it's got me, it's definitely like, it was fast paced. It's very intriguing, and this is the type of book I like. So I'm definitely excited for the next issue.
Gotcha. I'm going to go with a 4 again. Not quite 4, 4.5. I'm not that far on it, but it's a really good book. It's a great number one. I worry that this one might be one of the ones that gets lost in the shuffle this week. I didn't hear a lot of buzz about it. So I hope people go back and check this book out if they didn't. Definitely a quality read, and I think it's going to be a really good series that delivers every week. The team is pretty solid, so. Yeah, I'd expect good things. All right. Next book. The Dreamy Number 2. Merv Pumpkinhead Ain't Happy. Sure, Merv doesn't exactly radiate happy at the best of times, but now, right now, a bunch of blank-faced strangers from between realities are taking local jobs. Foreign criminals are profiteering at the realm's expense, and the VIP seem more interested in themselves than getting back to the good old days. The Dreaming used to be somewhere a vegetable-headed guy could be proud to call home, you know? Fact is, Merv Pumpkinhead's being pushed too far. It's time for a change right at the top. Written by Simon Spurrier. Artist Bilkis Everly. Colorist Matt Lopes. Letters by Simon Bolin. Cover by Jay Lee and June Chung. Created by Neil Gaiman. Published by Vertigo. The Dreaming. I really liked the first Dreaming. I remember being the one on the show. I was like, oh, it's right in my wheelhouse. It's Sandman. This is the best. And I still think so far this is the best of these new Sandman books coming out. I've read all the others that have come out since, and I still think the Dreaming really hits the notes I want from Sandman. And I love the characters, and it's driving the story of where is Dream. Merv was hilarious. This comic is about Merv. All the way. He's crotchety. He's angry. He sees everything falling apart around him and nobody is stepping up. And he knows something's wrong. And at the end, he finally finds out the Dream is missing, something we learned in the first issue. And he makes a very bold and crazy step in hopes of correcting it. And I'm not going to give that one away. That's kind of a spoiler for Sandman fans. What he chooses to do, but this book is great. The art is outstanding. The writing is Sandman-esque. Definitely a fantastical world with a lot going on. But Merv brings a whole other voice to it this week. You know, Merv's the crotchety old guy. So, yeah, good times. Fred, did you get a chance to read The Dreaming?
I did. I did read it. I actually started reading it after you mentioned that it was centered around Merv, which I think I mentioned in the first episode of the first issue of The Dreaming. He happens to be one of my favorite characters. And the reason being is he doesn't care what he says. He's definitely a character that's very likable. And I would have to say that the art in this book is tremendous. I like how the story is centered around this character. It's really done well. Man, I never thought I was going to like this book, but I'm two issues in and I'm going to start adding it to my pull list.
It's definitely the best of the ones I've read so far. And I'm a Sandman fan. I'm still going to read the others, but this is the one that seems to be hitting. And I love the world and I love how it's being drawn. You know, you feel like you're a dream. Some of the crazy things that are happening mm-hmm. around you and these characters that are Alice in Wonderland-ish for people who don't read Sandman. That's one of the best comparisons I can give you. You know, like characters do things that don't really make a lot of sense sometimes, like they do in Alice in Wonderland. Get on this book if you like this style of stuff, if you like fantasy, mm-hmm. if you like old style fairy tales almost. And yeah. It's a bit deeper than maybe your average comic. Maybe I'm just because I like it, I think it's deeper, but I really...
Yeah, no, I was just going to say it definitely is deeper. But like centering it around the character Merv kind of makes it a little easier to understand because you can have some fun with mm-hmm. it at the same time.
Yeah. Where the last issue was around, and now I'm not remembering her name, but it was around the young character who the woman.
Is it Dora?
Yeah, Dora, who can move between the worlds, and they don't understand how it is she can do it. So that was centered around her. And so, no telling. And then actually, that first little bit was centered around the librarian guy. So, who's next? Maybe it'll be the twin guys, Cain and Abel. We'll see. But I really like this book. It's high on my pull, but I am a Sandman fan, so I'm a little biased. So I'm going to go ahead and give my score, and I'm going to give it a 4.5. This is my highest for the week so far. Really big fan of this. Fred, what would you give it?
Just because of Merv alone, it's worthy of a 4. I'm going to give it a 4. And like I think I mentioned to you, like there's two characters in comics right now that really intrigues me. And it's Merv the Pumpkinhead and the Grandmas from the Coyotes. So, I mean, they kind of have similar tones in their dialogue. It's very interesting. I definitely say jump on this book.
Would they get along or would they just bicker with each other?
I think they would bicker. And that's what would make it so interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Very cool. All right. The next book we have on our list, Border Town Number 2. After barely surviving a supernatural showdown at Jack in the Box, the kids regroup over nachos to debate what to do when your own town is overrun by monsters of myth. Frank's freaked and wants to go to the cops. Julieta can't believe her family's undocumented. Oh, can't because her family's undocumented, excuse me. Amy wants to know the secrets of the underworld, and Quinteth might just be hungry. Meanwhile, El Chupacabra crosses the border between worlds, bringing with him an unspeakable, terrifying force to Devil's Fork. Written by Eric Esquivel. Art and cover, Ramon Villalobos. Colorist, Tamara Bolvillan. Letters by Darren Bennett. Published by Vertigo. Border Town. So, Fred, we loved this book. Mm-hmm. We all gave it a 5. It's the only book we've unanimously given a 5. We did that for issue 1. Does this book stay at the level or does it sink a little for you? Or how did you feel about Border Town?
I love this book. I don't know if it's, you know, right at a 5 because it doesn't have the same – like the first issue had the political tones and things like mm-hmm. that. This one's more on the mythology. But it did win me over with the wrestling, the luchador masks and the story behind it. Because as you know, in my house, wrestling is a religion. So that was huge there because we have luchador masks all over my home. And the art in this book is tremendous, especially like there's little, you know, nods to like Kyle Rayner and you mentioned Selena. It's a really good book and I'm interested to learn more about the mythology of like the Hispanic culture because, you know, I don't know like all the characters. I know the Chupacabra and a few other, but there was a little, Yeah, there's a lot of them in that one panel that were all there, and I'm like, whoa, what is all this? Because it was that was interesting to me. So I'm
hitting the Google.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. But you know what's crazy is my kids probably know all of them because they're into that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The book, this one didn't have as much of the political, like you said. It was more of an advancing of the story. This one just felt like an adventure. You have kids going on an adventure. You know, something has brought these kids together. And they try to go apart like they always do. But now they've been brought back together again. And so now they're stuck on an adventure. And we kind of learned that the little chupacabra really maybe isn't so bad either. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting take. And that there's something else that's worse than him. Like all those creatures you mentioned.
Yeah.
And then their leader. And finally we get, once again, the wise old sage grandmother character who... tries to save them at the end, and you get that panel of that thing that makes this particular part of the world so interesting. Why is this happening right here in this border town?
Right.
So it was a lot of fun.
Like my favorite part of this book was around the character Quintet, because he's scared. He's scared to go into the real world. And the only way he can face it is to wear a mask and hide behind it like a luchador, because it gives him enough confidence to deal with things on the day. And that was huge because, you know, there's people that are afraid of things, and it just shows you, you know, we all deal with things differently, and this is how he deals with it. I thought that was actually pretty beautiful, actually, because my wife works with kids that have some cognitive issues, and it's you know, it's to see kids that there's kids on, you know, that she works at the school with that have to have certain things. Like there's this one kid that he has to have Thriller playing and things, and it gives him confidence. Like that's what he associates with. So to me, that one hit home because we see certain things in our daily life. So that was huge. That's a good nod by Eric right there.
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, you have this single mom who just, okay, I'm going to come up with a way so that you can face your problems. Yeah. Really cool. He's such a cool. And he's a big dude. You know, you think, what do you have to be scared of? But yeah, it's even a big guy could have some anxiety issues, some social anxiety. Yeah. I like all the characters a lot. The art, you mentioned it. Villalobos was, he was meant to draw this book. Mm-hmm. This is the book that's going to allow him to just shine. I mean, he's drawn other great things, but. Just like you said, the little references. I know he's a Kyle Rayner fan because he's mentioned Rayner before. I follow him on Twitter.
Hey.
Drawing a little Selena poster, drawing all the luchador stuff in the kids' room. Just all these little things in the girls' room. There's little subtle references to the culture you would find in a Hispanic border town that is going to have a Hispanic influence, but also at the same time have an American influence. So it's a Mexican-American, you know. But you can
definitely tell that these guys are having fun with this book. It shows in their work.
Yeah, this book is going to be a lot of fun, and I like that where it's going. And like you said, the political stuff is a little toned down this time, and there's nothing wrong with there being political in the first one, and there's nothing wrong with being less in this one. That's what the story calls for.
I mean, you do have a little bit of it with the kid, the Nazi kid, and seeing his dad, and that's an interesting part of the story too, because now you can see where he's kind of acting that way because it starts at home. So that's interesting.
Well, it usually is, unfortunately.
Right.
But I guess Eric Esquivel has said that, you know, these are people that he kind of knew. He's basing this off of people he's experienced in his life. Right. And there are some kids that get mixed up in the wrong things and believe some crazy things. I'm really excited. So what would you score this book?
I wouldn't quite give it a 5, but I would definitely give it a 4.5.
Yeah, same. I'd give it a 4.5. It's not quite a 5 this time around. I mean, maybe it's because the first one, all the hype too. You got to give it to that. It was so much hype. And this one kind of just snuck in on everyone this week. There wasn't as much hype.
Right. I mean, but 4.5, that's really good. Like, normally I'd be like, I don't even hand those out that much.
But a very good book. Again, don't drop this one. Stick with it. I think you'll be – it's a quick read too. That's one of those books you just go through really quickly and you're like, wow, it's over. Bummer. And you just go back and look at the panels for cool things in the background and stuff.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Our next book is United States versus Murder, Inc. Number 2. In a world where the five families of Murder, Inc. never gave up the stranglehold on parts of America, the U.S. president tried to pit them against one another and failed badly. Now the families are united in their common cause, and there will be blood. Written by Brian Michael Bendis, art and covered by Michael Avon Oming, colorist Taki Soma, letters by Carlos M. Mangual, published by Jinx World, United States vs. Murder, Inc. Fred, what'd you think of United States vs. Murder, Inc.?
I can tell you that these are the type of characters that Mr. Bendis should be writing, the street level stuff. Maybe he should put away the capes right now and focus on this, because this is a wonderful book. Now, it's not, I wouldn't say it's as great as the first issue, but it's up there. I mean, it moves the story along. It's good. And something that's unlike his books is that there's not that much dialogue in this book. It's a, you know, no, not like the, would you say like the post-it notes where he just updates the stuff from the future or the previous issues? None of that. He, from the beginning of this book, it takes place with the fight with Jagger, and she has to prove herself, and she's fighting like this big goon, Guido Mafia dude. And, she just does everything and anything. Like, you could tell she is not afraid to back down, and she will do anything to win. Yeah. Whether it's like using her fingers or she's finding something to just finish him. I mean, it's definitely showed that she's the person for that position. Now, I thought like, you know, I thought this book was really good, but it does jump around a lot. Three different areas of her life. Some that could be considered emotional when she runs into her uncle. But it's definitely good. Like, I was not lost. And now I can see how he can advance the story to the current run that he left off with.
Yeah.
Which is cool, because I enjoyed it. And like I said earlier with the mobster gangster stuff, I'm all in. This is a great book.
Yeah. That fight at the beginning was brutal. I was going to bring that. That was such a brutal fight.
Yeah.
I was just like, and most of it is art. There's very little dialogue.
There's no dialogue for like what, 9 or 10 panels, and that's something different for Brian Michael Bendis.
Exactly. To trust the artist, and you're right, it's brutal. She does anything to win, and she's getting pummeled by this guy that's three times her size. And another interesting with the art is the color palette. I don't know if you noticed. I mean, it's some strange colors.
Yeah.
Like pink skins, red skins. I mean, you know what I mean? Like it's willing to embrace some really strange color choices. It's not realism, but at the same time, the material kind of lends a bit to realism. You know, a mafia story that anyone who's read or seen any movie about the mafia is going to understand really quickly. You know, about, okay, this is an assassin that has to prove herself to the Don. Then the Don gives her a very difficult task to truly prove her loyalty. She has to take out somebody who's very special to her personally. And then we're finally, like you said, I think we're at the real current continuity. You know what I mean? Like, that was the end of the backstory, and now we're going to kind of move forward with current continuity that fits where the first run was. She's a cool character. She's a really cool character. And I like the fact that we're seeing a breakdown of trust between her and the people she works for. So it's just, we're going to get a gang war. It's just a matter of time. And that's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a fun ride. I mean, the first two issues, it's been really good. This one isn't as intense, I don't think, like as the beginning. Maybe it was because it was the first issue and it had that hit girl kind of vibe, but now she's kind of established. Like, she's a professional. You can tell she's a cleaner. There's no doubt about it.
Crazy. Did she kill her uncle, do you think?
Did he take care of himself? It seemed like he took care of himself, but then part of me wonders, did he even shoot himself, or did they just shoot the gun off and he took off?
Mm-hmm.
Because she did give him that option, right?
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, I don't know. That's left very vague. That's something hanging out there. And she gave him the money back. That was also interesting. You know, yeah, because he told her to hold on to the money.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. She gave that to the godfather. So, yeah. But the final panel with the guy that she's talking to is very interesting because I read into some things, but I don't want to spoil it.
Ah, okay.
I'll leave it off the podcast.
There you go. Yeah, this is a good book. This is Bendis. This is what you're right. These are the things that I like from Michael Bendis. He needs to get away from Big Blue because it's not quite clicking, in my opinion. But that's a whole different podcast. We'll leave it there. And give us more of this. You know, right. This is what I enjoy. This is the one of the Jinx World books that I really like and I'm going to be buying on a regular basis. There's no doubt about it. So a score for Murder, Inc.
For this this issue, I would definitely give it a 4. I thought it was well done. And it just proves that he can trust the rest of his team to tell the story without him, you know, putting it on himself.
Yeah. This is the key to being able to do a lot of books. You have to trust some artists sometimes. Because if you're micromanaging as many books as he's doing, you're going to fall apart. So, yeah, he's trusting the guys. I would give it a 4. Yeah, I liked it a lot. Like I said, I've added it to my poll officially, 2 issues in, and I'm sold. I wanted to see how this ends. The main character, Jagger, is really interesting. It's a mafia story. Yeah. Good stuff. All right. Last but not least, Lollipop Kids number 1. When immigrants came to the new world, they didn't only bring their hopes and dreams, they also brought their monsters. Years ago, early settlers locked these monsters away in a secret prison deep in the woods of New Amsterdam so that they never would return to the old world again. Those woods have become Central Park, and now the monsters have escaped. Nick, 14, finds out that he is a legacy to a secret society that for the last 400 years has kept these monsters in check. And he and a ragtag group of kids just like him have to put the monsters back before they get out of the park and destroy the city. Brought to life by Adam Glass and Aiden Glass with art by Diego Yampur, Lollipop Kids is an epic reimagining of the things that go bump in the night. Like I said, written by Adam Glass and Aiden Glass, artist Diego Yampur, colorist DC Alonso, letters by Saul Cipriano, covered by Robert Hack. Variant cover by David Lopez. Published by Aftershock. Lollipop Kids. This book was surprisingly really good. I didn't know where it was going. That solicit makes it like a little more obvious that they're fighting these old monsters that are in Central Park. And it's a group of kids who've been tasked with that. You don't get that right away. That happens, the back third of the book maybe? So the first third is about this young kid who's looking for his sister who's been missing for days and how their relationship fell apart due to the fact that their mother was killed in Central Park. Because Central Park used to be their place to hang out, their place to play, their place to escape. And because their mother was killed there, they really don't go into Central Park anymore. But on this day, as he's looking for his sister, he goes back into Central Park. And he discovers some clues, and he finds the rest of the Lollipop Kids in something, well, I guess it'd be like a giant werewolf. And they help put it back. And the story goes on, and you get the backstory of what the Lollipop Kids are. What's really cool about this book is Aiden Glass is the 14-year-old son of Adam Glass. So you have the son helping the father write this interesting, fun tale. And you can just tell this is the kind of thing you read to your kids at night, you know, a bedtime story. And I think this is a lot of fun. I really like this one. I was surprised.
Yeah, I definitely think this is a good book. I mean, I read a review before we got the review copy, and they did not like this book. And I was wondering if I was reading the same book after I read the review copy. I'm like, because this book was so well done, whether it's the art or the voice that Nick has, like he's telling the story and his thinking and things like that, and telling his struggles with dyslexia, and mentioning that, you know, all these smart people like Albert Einstein and stuff. But you could later find out in this book that he has some of those qualities because he's finding these clues and it's leading him to somewhere. So I thought that was really interesting. And of course, who doesn't like LARPing? I mean, when they're, you see these kids doing this stuff. So that interested me. I mean, I definitely want to try that one day. My wife won't let me, but I'm going to do that before I kick the bucket. So quote me on that. Yeah. but yeah, this is a fun book. It's definitely like lighthearted. I feel like it's lighthearted for an Aftershock book because Aftershock books are like so deep. And this one is actually pretty fun. I mean, it seems to be pretty fun. And after you read the solicit, I'm interested to see like the next couple of issues where it's going to go because it's definitely cool. I mean,
yeah, I think the fact that we all have the darkness is the influence of his son on this book, you know? So the horror is minimized. You know, that creature could have easily been much more terrifying, you know, but it's almost a little comical the way they take it down. They're like arguing each kid, like, I could have used my powers. I could have took it down really fast, but I knew you had it, so I just watched, you know, like you would expect young kids to do.
Yeah, it kind of feels like they're dealing with like real life nursery rhymes.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes total sense. And so, yeah, because these monsters from the old world that came here. And that's what a great idea. You know, how believable that was a forest, of course, in New Amsterdam before it just became the park. And, you know, the park is so massive. Yeah, I really liked it. Like I said, it's a bedtime story. It's something you read to your kids. But also, it's a fun read. I don't understand why someone would hate it. I can see someone saying, maybe it's not for me. It's a little too lighthearted. But I don't think it was written poorly, and I don't think the art was – I think the art was really good. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a good story because you think about, like, the mother having died, and then you have, like, Nick having the tension between his sister because she's – I think it said, like, she's turning 18, and he's afraid that she's going to leave him too.
Yeah.
So there's a couple things in this book that is very interesting, like – dynamics. And then you have like the dad that's, you know, so Irish and stuff that he has no feelings. I can tell you that it happens in the Irish family, from one side of my family. So it's definitely, you know, like it's a very interesting book. I'll definitely give you that. And with the name Lollipop Kids, I totally thought it was going to be something like, I thought it was going to be like Wizard of Oz kind of feel with that, you know. I don't really read the solicits. I more so look at like who's going to be writing a book and look at the title. That's it. That's all I look at.
Same. Because you know what? If I'd have read that solicit, I'd have been a little mad because it gives away a little too much for me. I'm glad that I didn't know that that's where it was going because I had no idea where it was going. You know, because the setting kind of tricks you because this is almost a story you'd expect in a smaller town or someplace with a forest or something. Not right smack dab in the middle of New York City, you know,
right.
Which makes it a cool story. That's a great idea if you ask me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So very enjoyable.
It's definitely a good book. That's for sure.
So let's go ahead about a score for Lollipop Kids. What would you hand out to it?
I would give this book a 4. And what I really enjoy about it is because my oldest Anthony is going to be turning 15 and him and I like read comic books together. So I can understand the bonding between Adam and Aiden Glass right there. So that's, this is something like, wow.
Yeah.
How awesome to be like 14 to write a book with your dad.
Oh yeah, exactly. Very cool. And see it come to life. Yeah, that must be amazing. Yeah, I'll give it a 4 as well. Like I said, I don't understand the hate. I thought it was a great book. And yeah, 4. And that concludes our long list of books for the week. And trust me, we left some good ones out, like The Magic Order and Die, Die, Die. And what's that Aftershock book? I already forgot it, but there's a really good Aftershock book. There's a lot of books this week, folks. And then Marvel and DC hit home runs as well. So we'll go ahead and have Chris join us, and we'll talk about some more books after we talk about X-Men What If?
Yeah. Can't wait.
Hey, guys. This is Andrew. In order to avoid a two-hour show, we decided to cut this episode in two. That way, we'll have plenty of time to hear all Chris has to share about his Marvel experience. So tune in on Wednesday when we drop in part 2 of episode 8, Chris's Marvel experience.